Today, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about turbulent magnetohydrodynamics of the Sun and numerical models thereof. I'm not using it. Right. Now you're in trouble, Ed. I can keep you at arm's length with this, though, at least. What I'd like to do is talk about some large-scale numerical simulations which are related to basic processes we think that are occurring in the Sun. So the simulations I'm going to portray are not simulations of the Sun per se itself, but rather simulations which sort of help us help build our physical intuition and understanding of some of the things which we think are going on in the Sun. And most of the work I'll give here has been done in conjunction with Steve Tobias sitting over there, Tom Clooney, who's not around, and Yuri Tumre, who's giving the next talk. There's a large overlap between some of the things I was going to say here and the next talk, which Yuri's going to give, but I'll try and stick to one particular aspect of large numerical simulations related to the Sun. Let's start off, what's it all about? Why are we doing this? Well, as Tom Berger gave you a great overview yesterday of all kinds of wonderful activity that happens on the Sun. Some of it purely fluid flow, and some of it magnetohydrodynamic. In other words, there's lots of magnetic fields going around. So ranging from simple things which we're all familiar with, like sunspots, and their quite amazing variation in the sunspot cycle, where the sunspots go and appear and disappear on an 11-year cycle. And here's a close-up of a sunspot in relation to the granulation that Tom talked about yesterday. So there's all this fantastic magnetic activity going on the Sun, which we all saw in beautiful technicolor yesterday. And the question is, where does it all come from? What is the source for this magnetic field? And how does it get into this strange state where it manages to be cyclically varying on a sort of time period of 11 years, which is very short compared to the lifetime of the Sun and compared to the magnetic diffusivity lifetime, for example. So this sort of behavior where it cycles very rapidly like that will tend us to think that it's probably a solar dynamo rather than some primordial effect of the magnetic field. It doesn't just haven't just been there forever and just sits there doing this by chance. It actually has some sort of regeneration process, because sunspots have to appear at certain latitudes and migrate and disappear and then reappear with a different polarity 11 years later. So this is a very ordered behavior, which would not be typical of just something which is running down. So the general belief these days is there is dynamo activity going on. And by dynamo, what I mean is that fluid motion or kinetic energy is being translated into magnetic energy in some manner against the axis of diffusion. So we think there are some dynamo properties of the Sun, some large dynamo which is operating in this beast, producing this sort of effect which we can measure at the surface. Now, of course, one of the problems with the Sun is that, in general, we can look very closely at the surface, or very clearly at the surface, but we can't see what's going on in the interior very well. So one of the roles of numerical simulations is to try and elucidate a little bit what happens below the surface of the Sun. If things fit with the observations, then, if we can make some comparisons with what comes out of observations, then we're doing reasonably well, and maybe we're understanding some of the physics. But anyway, this process which generates sunspots and this magnetic cycle is probably what we would call the large-scale dynamo. In other words, some global phenomena are occurring. There's something which is associated with the whole size of the object itself. In other words, it's a global-scale sort of effect, and is generating this magnetic field over on very large scales. As you can see, sunspots, you know, are visible, so they're very, very large compared to granulation, which is quite a lot smaller. So there's obviously something of very, very small scale. So as you saw in Tom's talk yesterday, there's granulation, but also in intergranular lanes, there is magnetic field of the scale of the intergranular lanes. There is those bright points, which Tom convinces me that they are associated with magnetic fields. So there's a magnetic field on that small scale, and something on this large scale of this sort of size too. So there's a huge dynamic range of magnetic activity on the Sun. The time scales are very different too. So obviously the small-scale bright points that we saw yesterday evolve on a granulation sort of time scale, as the sunspots have an 11-year cycle. So there's a large range of scales. So this is indicative of turbulence, a huge range of scales. So our understanding of the makeup of the Sun is that the materials are such that we would expect turbulent dynamics in the in the hydrodynamics of this thing, because the Reynolds number, pick your favorite large number of order 10 to the 12 or larger, and diffusivities are very, very small. So we expect this thing to be very turbulent and very active. So there's a large-scale dynamo which produces this sort of effect, and then just because this whole fluid motion field is very, very turbulent, we would probably expect there to be what we could call a small-scale dynamo. In other words, if you put, if this is an electrically conducting fluid, if it's turbulent, its particle trajectories within this fluid are probably very chaotic. So that it's almost guaranteed that in some sense, any small motions of this nature will be a dynamo too. So there's two sort of dynamos really going on in the Sun. They are connected, and that's something we're going to talk about. But one is associated with all the small-scale turbulent motions, and the other is the large-scale dynamo which produces things like sunspots. Now, it's fairly well known from simple models of dynamos that there's a couple of effects or a couple of dynamical processes which we need to make any of this stuff work at all. And I'm going to talk about these briefly, and we'll come back to them a little later. And the first thing is the Ohm effect. What we basically have to do is to transfer the two types of field we find on the Sun between the two different components. There's a toroidal field, which is banded axial field, and there's poloidal field, which is the rest, sort of dipole sort of nature field, which you're familiar with seeing. So these two types of field can be called the two components of the field of the Sun, and what you have to do is be able to translate between those two types of field. So you have to be able to take poloidal field, which is this dipole nature, and turn it into some sort of toroidal field. And we think if there's a differential rotation on the Sun, which it turns out there is, and I'll talk about that in a second, then if you take a poloidal field and stretch it by moving it differentially faster at the equator than you do at the poles, then you can create some toroidal field. So that's one way of converting between one component and the other. And the other thing is, can you convert from a toroidal field, for example, something axial in this direction, back into something which has components in the poloidal direction? And very loosely using these terms, alpha effect and omega effect, in mean field models this would have a very specific meaning, but here I'm just using it loosely. You can regenerate poloidal field by lifting up a piece of toroidal field in a background where there is rotation or some sort of asymmetry to the motion, so that they always have some preferred handedness. So if you can lift something up and twist it a little bit, you'll get some component of the poloidal field back. And that's a sort of alpha effect. Anyway, the Sun very conveniently provides us with the first. Helioseismology, listening to the sound waves which are emitted by the Sun, is a best and only way of probing the interior at the moment. And it's come up with quite a good understanding of how the angular velocity varies with depth. So this is the mean angular velocity in the azimuthal direction. And so the thing that has been found is that there's fairly constant on radial lines throughout the convection zone. And as Tom mentioned yesterday, the outer third of the sun's radius is convecting. So fairly constant throughout the convection zone, but then a sharp transition to a strong shear at the bottom, which has been called the Tappert line. And as you can see from this plot, and as Tom mentioned yesterday as well, there's also a differential rotation between the equator and the poles, so the equator is moving faster than the poles, which is just the sort of stuff we needed for that omega effect to be able to drag out poloidal field lines into toroidal field lines. So this is where the transition to a stable configuration happens, according to the Schwarzschild criteria. Yeah. Okay. Right. So we come up, this is background at the moment, we come up with some sort of picture for the operation of this global dynamo as this something like this sketch that I have right here. This is a very, very simple sketch of some of the components we think are necessary to be able to operate that large-scale global dynamo. And these ideas are what's known as an interface dynamo scenario, and this was proposed by Parker in 1993. He made some mean field modeling of this type of scenario. And the idea is to have to circumvent some of the problems in these alpha and omega generations. And to do that, what you do is actually separate the regions of generation of toroidal field from the generation of poloidal field. So what I've sketched here is this is the convection zone down to this dotted line again, and this is the stable region below. And you have convection going on up here, and What convection does is either has some poloidal field in it or generates some poloidal field in some way. And remember, like we said, there is a small-scale dynamo going on in there as well, so you can generate field. And then if you can get that poloidal field out into this lower zone where that differential rotation is strong, the Tackett line, remember there's a strong layer of shear just below that constant layer. And so if you can get the field into this stable regime right here, then you can stretch it out by the differential rotation, then you can amplify that magnetic field in a toroidal sense very strongly. So if you keep pulling that out, keep stretching it, keep stretching it, keep stretching it, you can make something very strong. Now, if by that process then you can make something which looks like tubes, you can make some sort of structures in the magnetic field, so an instability of the magnetic field which makes it look something undular or tube-like, of which we know some processes already, for example, the magnetic buoyancy instability, then this thing will be less dense than its surrounding because the magnetic field adds to the pressure, to the total pressure, so the density inside a flux tube goes down. And if it reaches sufficient strength, then it will maybe want to rise. And if it rises in the effect of a background rotation, then maybe it'll twist. That'll give us the alpha effect, the dynamic alpha effect that we were looking for. And maybe this tube, if it rises as a loop, will come out of the surface and look a little bit like a sunspot. The toroidal field. Excuse me? Okay, we'll mention that in a second. This rise of these strong magnetic toroidal structures in the background rotation can be a dynamic alpha effect. So you can get some poloidal field back from the breakup of these things, or from the recycling of these things. If these things aren't strong enough to make it through the convection zone of sunspots, then they recycle, and this whole process begins again. Well, there's a number of possible ways of making poloidal field. It can be from the breakup of these things, or it can be convection acting itself on whatever background field it has in a small-scale dynamo manner, which can then be removed and recycled again. And it's not known what is happening. That is not known which of those things happens. Yes! That's what this talk's all about. Thank you very much, Dana. Most kind of you. So what you need is to be able to get some field out of the convection zone into the tack line as one of the steps of this mechanism. So there's two things I'm going to talk about today. A little bit of background about what convection really decent turbulent convection looks like. And then what I'm going to talk about is what Dana just mentioned, the fact that you have to somehow get field out of the convection zone, if it's in the convection zone already, into the stable layer of the Tackett line. Now, I'll just mention one thing. Mean field models of this scenario were made by Parker and have been since followed up by people like Paul Charbonneau and Keith McGregor. And this scenario works very well in a mean field sense. You have to parameterize certain things. You have to parameterize the alpha effect. You have to parameterize the shear as an omega effect. And you have to parameterize this process of getting field out of the unstable layer into the stable layer as a turbulent diffusion. So turbulent diffusion is sort of just a parameter in those models. We don't really know what it means. And our goal, and with the sort of simulations we've been doing, is to say we're going to do fully nonlinear simulations of parts of this problem and try and work out, not get rid of the parameterization. So we're going to try and work out what turbulent diffusion really means in this sense, in this transport here. Yes, you can amplify the flux in the dynamo mechanism. Yeah, the total flux is fixed, yeah. It's just a matter of how you move it around, yeah. And where are you trying to do this? The toroidal flux is the thing which was really fluctuating, which we're looking at. I'm not sure about the poloidal flux. I'm not sure. Does it? So the sort of models we're going to look at right here, because we want this process to be very turbulent, are what we call local models. So we take out a very small piece. Instead of trying to model the whole sun in global modeling, which is the sort of stuff that Yuri's going to talk about next, we just extract a small piece out of this thing to make our numerical model. And the thing to notice here is that this particular type of model has just what we were looking for. We have an unstable layer on the top and a stable layer below. This we enforce by a thermal conductivity profile. So what to do this, we just have two different thermal conductivities in the two different layers. And basically, the underlying background state for this model is two polytropes, one unstable and one stable. And there's a ratio of the polytropic indices, which is this S, which gives you a measure of the stability. So the only thing you really need to know is that the larger S, the more stable the lower layer. So the stiffer and the more hard it's going to be to enter that stable layer, the larger the S. I won't show you the equations. So what I want to give you an idea about is just what this sort of convection looks like. And then I'm going to show you a quick movie of it. So here's a couple of different views of this type of convection. Here's the box. This marks the transition from unstable to stable, which is fixed and does not depend on the property. So it's fixed in space and doesn't change. And this is looking at the vertical velocity where upflows, warm upflows are colored in red and the cold downflows are colored in blue. Now you can see from this plot that the surface has something of a granular-like nature. Now this is a dimensionless calculation, so the scale of these things is not set. The only thing you have to judge by is the number of scale heights, the density contrast across this thing, which is fairly large, like 25, but the density contrast across the whole convection zone is 1,000 or so in the sun. So these could be the lower part of the convection zone of this calculation is the way to think about it. But there are some sort of laminar, sort of sailor-like looking structures at the top with a network of downflows connected and upflow between, which goes out and then down in a sailor sort of nature. But if you look at these things, it's hard to see in this plot, but we'll look at the next one in a second. There's a smaller scale action going on down the bottom. So if you look here at this plot, this is the entropy density, which is the magnitude of vorticity squared. So what you're looking is at highly active fluid elements in this, and other things which are spinning fast in some sense. And you can see this one is a direct relation to this one. There's fluid tends to flow to the interstices or to the junctions of these cells and then down these cells. And at those corners, what you'll find is a strong chimney of vorticity. So this is a very, what we would call a strong, coherent, downflowing structure. So fluid comes out and then to the walls, down along the walls, and then down the corner of the wall. So this is a very strong downflowing structure. And as you can see, there's a number of these strong downflowing structures associated with this upper network. And then where it enters the stable layer and becomes rapidly decelerated by buoyancy breaking, you get a lot of turbulence. So in other words, this thing sort of splashes against the bottom and causes a lot of turbulence, which is sucked up in the return flow, and you can see quite a lot of turbulence in the interior of this flow as well. So it has a fixed temperature on the top, it's stress-free. The magnetic field, this one doesn't have magnetic field in it actually, but when we put the magnetic field in, you can either have the horizontal components of B equal to zero in there, or you can have dBx and dBy by dz equal to zero.
Yes, the bottom box seems to be related to the top box, it's just a half of the top box, right?
No, it's all of it. That's the thing. This is parasitic convection, so this has no reason to stop when it hits this boundary. This is not a solid boundary. So what it can do is overshoot somewhat into that zone. But that zone is stable, so the buoyancy of those motions are going to be reversed when it hits that boundary. And then they're going to try and go back up.
So how stable is the lower?
Well, that's that stability ratio S. And for this case, S equals 7, which means that the ratio of the polytropic indices is 1 to 3 or something like that.
Seven times stable.
No, I mean exactly what I had on that previous slide here. What I mean is that these two things are measured by two polytropes. This has a polytropic index 1, so M1 is 1. This one has a polytropic index M2 of some value. So for that one, which was S equals 7, M2 is equal to 5. Well, I'm going to show you the depth of penetration in a second, if that's what you're actually after. Whoa. Oh, just before we go on, this is the same sort of thing, except this is a non-turbulent case. Didn't come out very well in the plot, sorry. But this is a low Rayleigh number. So the Rayleigh number of that one is about 1,000,000. The Rayleigh number of this one, so that one's highly supercritical. The Rayleigh number of this one is about 7,500. Critical is around 1,000, somewhere like that. So this one has a much more cellular nature. This one's still penetrating, but you can see there's much more normal convection where you just have walls going down everywhere. So let me show you a quick movie of the...
Your definition of Rayleigh numbers is...
At the mid-depth of the unstable layer. Yeah. Oops, I'm retracting these things. Okay, so this is going to be just a quick movie of what this thing looks like. I don't know whether you can see it back there, okay. And where's the lights? Oh, they're over there. Okay, now this is the entropy gain. And so you can see that the midplane of this box is up here somewhere. And so you can see that there's strong structures. Actually, we'll see one in a minute over here somewhere. Here we go. A strong downflow comes down. Oh, missed it. Okay. We'll go around again in a second. Actually, I can make it go around again. Let's start again.
What's your resolution here?
The resolution of this one. Hang on a sec. I've got to catch this thing. Yeah. Let's go back to the beginning. The resolution of this one, I think, is 256 by 256 by 350. So you can see some of these strong downflowing chimneys here, and at the bottom of these chimneys is splashing and turbulence being created, but this is below the middle. So if you watch, there's one over here happens in a little while. There we go. There's a good strong downflow. See how it penetrated below. We're going to talk about that depth of penetration in a second. Excuse me? Right, so it's halfway down. And this box is exactly halfway down. So anything below halfway here is penetration. It's coming down. So you saw it penetrate there. This is looking at it from the top. So here you can see the cellular nature in the entropy at the top, the cell walls. So a downflow would roll up two vortices by the sides of the downflow. So you see this double-edged effect. And this is looking at it from underneath. So if you look from underneath, you can see there's a lot of small-scale turbulence going on. The aspect ratio of this one is 6 by 6 by 2. This is entropy density, yes. So that's a little bit about what it looks like, but the thing to notice is, once again, this penetration of the plumes below into the unstable layer. Blank that out. Let's get that on. There's no shear flow in this tachocline, no, not right now. Okay, so one of the interesting things is this thing does penetrate. And as Peter was asking, for different levels of the stability down the bottom of that layer, you have different depths of penetration. And here's a plot. If you measure the kinetic energy flux, which is basically where this goes to zero, it says there's no motions below that level. So this is an easy way of looking at how far motions penetrate. So if you look at have some measure of how close this thing goes to zero. So here's zero, here's one. And obviously for the ones which are squidgier down below, the lower S's, you have to have a deeper box. So how far do these things penetrate? Well, as you'd expect, there's some dependence on S on how these things penetrate. So the squidgier they are, for S equals 1, for example, it penetrates a long way. S equals 2, a little less. S equals 3, a little less. S equals et cetera, et cetera. So this penetration, as the lower layer gets more stable or stiffer, the penetration gets less. S is the stability ratio between the unstable and stable layer. So the larger S, the more stable the lower layer is. Yes, there's a very, very sudden jump. That tachocline is a very sudden jump to a much, much more stable configuration. So there's actually a scaling with these S's, which Jean-Paul is the expert in, and this is a plot for Jean-Paul in a lot of ways, which measures how the scalings go. But I think, seeing as time is going on fast, I'm going to actually skip how these things scale and what it means. And Jean-Paul, I'll have to talk to you later to show you the latest plot. So anyway... no, that's a shame because this is good stuff. The point is that you have this type of penetration, and we can use that to see if it has any effect on magnetic field. Well, I could, and I really want to, but I'm running out of time rapidly. How much time do I have, Mr. Chairman? So I have to go on, I'm afraid. I'll have to talk to you later, Jean-Paul. The question is, can this act on the magnetic field? So here's a little experiment we do. We take a simulation which looks just like we saw before, with these strong plumes splashing into a stable layer, and we, in an act of God, add a magnetic layer in the middle of this layer, just put it on in there. And the question is, what happens to that magnetic layer? So now I'll try and show you a little movie of that. The field is in the Y direction and is constant in strength, and it's a horizontal field, yeah. No, it has resistivity. Right. Excuse me, sorry. Right. So, this is what happens to it. Let's see if we can get this thing started. So you can see it started with a layer right in the middle there, and as I let it go, the bright blue and green is the strong magnetic field. The purple here and the white and purple in this color table is the entropy. So there's two fields mixed here. So you can still see the chimneys in entropy. I wanted people to go to see the fluid flow a little bit, so you can still see the entropy density. But the blue and green is the magnetic field. So where you get bright yellow and green is the strongest magnetic field. So I'll run that again. Oops, didn't want to do that. Actually, let's do this. No, this is just the magnetic field. So let's have a look at this. So as you can see, there's a sort of a rise of the layer initially, which is some advection by the upflows and magnetic buoyancy, because of course this whole layer will be buoyant because the density is evacuated a little bit there. But after a while, as you can see now, all the strong magnetic field is down here low in the box. And actually, most of the magnetic flux, this has a net flux, this field, is down below the halfway point. So you can see the strong bright points in this. This is magnetic energy we're looking at here, but I'll show you flux in a minute. The strong bright points are now low in the block, so you can see it's not very high. Let's see if I can run that again. And you can get the feel for it. So you can see initially there's a rise, and then there's all kinds of activity goes on, and then gradually the stuff settles down to lower in the box. So, thermal conductivity is constant. The thermal diffusivity has a factor of 1 over rho. The Prandtl number in this is constant. Yes, I guess that's true. Well, they're all low in this case. I mean, I guess I don't know what you want to say. I guess the thermal diffusion is certainly changed because of the density factor, but the density factor is not huge in these things. I mean, they are buoyant, but not hugely buoyant. I mean, as a fraction of the mean density, the loss in density is fairly small. Well, depending on the magnetic field. But anyway, here's a quick review of that result. You start off with an initial field which is imposed. It starts to rise a little bit initially in the upflows and by magnetic buoyancy, but then the strong coherent structures grab hold of the magnetic field and advect it down. And there's two effects going on here. This is the magnetic energy we're looking at. So not only does it grab the field and advect it down, but it also, in that turbulent regions which you saw in the splashing regions, winds it up and stretches the magnetic field, so there's local dynamo action. So there's actually local amplification of the magnetic field in those turbulent regions.
Do you amplify the field overall?
No, it's not a dynamo calculation. This one's actually a rundown calculation, because in this case, you have B equals zero boundary conditions on the outside, so you can lose flux from near this box. So it's not done as a dynamo calculation, it's done as a magneto-convection calculation. There's a slight difference. Mike? The magnetic Reynolds number of this one is about 200 or so. It does have small-scale local action, but it does not amplify the magnetic field as a whole if you do the volume average over the whole box in this case. So here's the details of that for, say, a couple of plumes. You can see two plumes here grab the magnetic field and drag it down, and eventually, in the small-scale action down here, there's some amplification and leaves weaker field above. But let's look at that a little bit more quantitatively. Now let's look at the flux, because the flux is the important thing that we want here. We actually want to be able to pump out flux into the lower region. So this is the average BY, so it starts off with a net BY constant, which is this strong layer right here, this thick line, and then over time are these lines. And you can see it diffuses upwards and moves upwards by magnetic, diffuses, it gets wider and moves upwards by magnetic buoy in the upflow advection to start with. So it starts going up towards this boundary. But then it starts regenerating a second peak down here. And you eventually end up with a fairly steady state profile, and this is it after long times, and it runs down gradually by diffusion because it's allowed to lose flux out of the boundaries. But it has a self-similar profile eventually, which has this peak down here, and notice this is below 1. So this has managed to remove magnetic flux, which initially was all in the convection layer, and stick it below the stable layer. So,
what fraction of magnetic
diffusion? This sort of thing is run for this sort of time, which is 80 sound crossing times, and the diffusion time. But you can see here's the pumping time. Okay, I better explain what this is. what I'm showing here is the fraction. So you measure that flux, and you integrate that flux in this stable layer from the bottom up to the stable layer, and from the top down to the top of the stable layer. So you have two fractions of the total flux in the box. So the total BY is this. And there's a fraction of the unstable and stable layer. If you normalize by this, you get a fraction. Okay. So here, the dashed line is the fraction in the unstable layer, and the solid line is the fraction in the stable layer. So to start with, there's zero in the stable layer, and all of it one in the unstable layer. And then you let this go, and what happens is the stuff in the unstable layer disappears and appears in the stable layer. And you can see these things cross over, so there's more flux in the stable layer after a short amount of time, which is about 6 or 7 time units, sound crossing times. Now, the diffusion time in these units is a few hundred. So this is very, very fast. This time scale is the convective turnover time scale. So it's a matter of how long it takes to just turn it over and churn it out, or a couple of convective turnover times. So if you normalize this sensibly, then you'll find. So as you can, the other thing you can see from this one is that this is the total flux, and the total flux runs down in this calculation. But if you measure the fraction of the current flux which is around, this comes to a stable value at about 75%. So it ends up for a long time with 75% of the flux in this stable region and only 25% in the unstable region.
Did you give us the ratio of B squared to rho V squared?
It will be less than unity. Yeah, this thing's nowhere near equipartition because it's running down. Yeah, like I said, this is not a dynamo calculation. We're not actually amplifying the full B squared.
Let me ask you, B zero squared, P equals zero, is it basically a passive vector?
No, this is quite strong, and actually maybe I should get on to that point. Okay. Let me come to that in a second. I'll reach that point in a second. Let's just mention one other thing. As I run out of time here. Where are we at? 5 minutes?
2 minutes.
Okay. Let me run on to another thing. If you originally put this this layer, instead of, remember, we imposed this layer in an act of God in the middle of the unstable layer. Say we didn't do that. Say we actually put it in the stable layer to start with. Then you can see from this calculation, it stays there for all time. It never. Some of it diffuses up and some of it a little bit gets dragged up by advection. But for all times, the peak of this flux is in the stable layer. So this is a mechanism for pumping field out, but it's also a mechanism for storing flux there. So if I put flux there in the first place, it'll keep it there, which is actually the same mechanism. I mean, it was not really necessary to do this calculation because after it's churning it up a little time, that's exactly that same configuration. But turbulent storage of flux. God, I brought about 3,000 too many view graphs here, I guess. I'm going to have to skip that as well. Let's just get to Pia's point here. Okay, I've got to explain this diagram quickly. This is just a plot of, if you plot where that maximum is with time, the maximum of the flux in that previous plot. So to start with, the maximum of that flux goes up, and then the maximum of the flux jumps down. It's in the unstable layer, and it pumps it a little lower, and then for all times, it sort of evens out, and the maximum of that flux stays down the bottom here. So this is a sort of a measure we call it of the pumping depth, where is it at. And if you take some sort of average of this thing, you get some sort of average pumping depth. Now, these are two plots for two different field strengths at the beginning of the calculation. The first one is very weak, has Chandrasekhar number Q equals 10. The second one is very strong, well, relatively strong, it has Chandrasekhar number Q equals 10,000. So this second field is, you know, 10 to the 4, you know, 10,000 times stronger than the first one. And this is the plot for the two things. As you can see, these two things are pumped almost identically. Even though this is a much stronger field, it's still fairly weak in terms of plasma beta. The magnetic pressure is still not that strong compared to gas pressure. Gas pressure is still dominating. But for something which is 10 to the 4 stronger, it's still pumping in an identical manner. And the flux function, if you look at it, this is the amount of flux in the stable layer, carries on, settles down for the two to be exactly the same thing, 75%. Now, since I'm running out of time, the interesting thing is these numbers are very, very independent of most of the parameters. So if I change the boundary conditions, I said I've done this as a rundown experiment with B equals zero boundary conditions. If I make it a no-flux boundary condition, so no flux can escape, this fraction stays the same, 75%. The things which change this fraction are how stiff I make the lower layer, for example. So only functions, parameters which are functions of the penetration, which affect the penetration. So if I make the bottom layer less stable so it can penetrate further, then this fraction will change because it can get more flux down deeper. But those are the only parameters which change the thing. So, in conclusion, 45 minutes is not, I'm used to an hour, I could do it in another 15 minutes. So in conclusion, the most point of this is that you can transport magnetic fields from the convection zone into the tactile zone. It's an essential feature of the large-scale dynamo, and we've proved in numerical simulations you don't have to do this by a turbine diffusion. It really is a process exists to do this. It really works in fully nonlinear magnetohydrodynamics. And so the ultimate conclusion, this Parker scenario for an interface dynamo is a very natural consequence of just turbulent panshift convection. This separation of generation of poloidal field by a dynamo in the convection zone, magnetic energy is generated very strongly in the convection zone because it's very turbulent motions, but flux will be pumped out below the convection zone into the stable layer where it can be amplified. And I think I better stop there, otherwise Mordecai is going to kill me. Oh, there was enough already.
Did I understand on the operation of the dynamo that maybe the toroidal flux is disturbed, but during the cycle it's just going to change? There's some positive toroidal flux and
right. Tachycline. I talked to Ed about that. He invented the word. Right. Right, magneto convection, yeah.
Yeah, what do you add
to turn it into a dynamo? Okay, there's a parameter in there. If you scale everything by the initial size of the magnetic field, B0, in your equations, then you have that's how you set the size of your magnetic field, and your magnetic field is measured in those terms. Then your equations come out with a certain scaling. You don't have a you have a parameter, Q, the Chandrasekhar number, which measures the strength of the magnetic field. Okay. If you don't do that, if you scale your magnetic field in units of the magnetic field energy in units of the kinetic energy, okay, and put in a small seed magnetic field, then it doesn't have any size to start with. You let it go, it can do whatever it wants, and it can grow magnetic energy. So that's the basic difference. Maybe Steve. Yeah, it does have dynamo action. No, it's one has an imposed magnetic field, the other doesn't. It's basically the differences. Oh, geez, I'm so popular. Of course. There's a lot of things. I mean, yeah, if you take one of these calculations and do run it as a pure dynamo calculation, it is a weak dynamo. It's not a very good dynamo because the diffusivities are too large, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Rotation would enhance it, it's true. But this is a dynamo without rotation, but it's not a very strong dynamo. It's a slow, I mean, I don't want to use slow, it's too technical a term, but it's a bad dynamo. we've done this sort of thing with rotation stuff as well, and you get the same effect. I mean, that's one of the things I was going to say. This this mechanism does depend on rotation too, but only in as far as rotation affects the penetration depth, which is a whole other sort of talk. Yes, Leon. Yes. Yes.
Going back to 50 years, 20 years ago, we pointed out that if you don't have diffusion, then the external vacuum moment will stay constant. You can actually have to do it. As soon as you have diffusion, then you can amplify and indeed cause now reverse.
Correct.
Now, I think in the model, going back to Parker and see back to so on, effectively they have an enormous effective diffusibility, the total diffusibility,
right.
To get utterly impossible.
Can I just mention one thing on that? I agree with you entirely. The point about these calculations is that this is stuff normally modeled as a turbulent diffusion. This process is in no way a diffusion. I mean, it's something which transports something from one place to another, which a diffusion can do, but this is no way a diffusion. Because one thing you can do with this is put a layer in which is constant everywhere, and you'll still end up with the same fraction of flux in the lower layer compared to the upper layer. And then you start off with a magnetic field which has no gradient, so it can't be a diffusion.
A lot of people approve it. Have you tried extrapolating your results to solar conditions as far as just the ratio of flux put into the part down to stratification that's realistic and stuff? Like, what fraction do you think is left?
Well, I mean, the answer to that question is no, and extrapolation is a little dangerous in these circumstances, but the highest stability we did here was S equals 30. If you talk to various people, we come up with all different numbers for what you think that value should be, but it's probably, I don't know, the average I get from people is about S equals 100. Okay. So it's not that far removed from what we were doing here. Again, this is a sort of fake calculation in the sense that you get a percentage of what we put in originally, and that's not the right answer, but it'll go down to some fraction, but it'll still be a significant fraction, I think. I mean, it won't be 3%. I mean, it'll be 40-50%. I couldn't say exactly what, but it'll still be a significant fraction. Because something is as far as it affects how much the penetration is reduced. And that scaling is fairly weak because it goes like S to the minus quarter. Yeah, that was a graph back. Thank you, Mike. If you let me show this one view graph, I'll put it right up there. Yeah, the method was called topological pumping by Jobyshevsky and Yuferev many years ago. And topological pumping basically said that if you have asymmetrical convection whereby the downflows are connected and the upflows are not connected, then field lines which lace this thing are going to be preferentially dragged down because there's a connectivity to the downflow, so it's going to drag things down. Whereas upflows are all bitty, they can't grab something and pull it up. So this mechanism is definitely not that mechanism. That mechanism is a kinematic mechanism, and so is ours in a lot of ways. But if you think about it, in ours, the downflows are less connected than the upflows. Now we have downflows, which are these sort of pinpricks coming down like this, and the upflows are sort of a small, slow-moving mass connected effect. So if it was that mechanism, it would pump the other way. As long as they're connected, but these aren't connected. Well, there's another point as well, then that's the fact that there is this local amplification or dynamo action, whichever term you prefer to use in this thing, which is definitely a non-kinematic effect.
Yeah. I didn't quite understand how this downflowing penetration actually gets, it doesn't transfer into the packet line, in the sense those magnetic field lines don't diffuse. Not going to get the amplification you want. So what's the mechanism?
No, it's advected. The field is advected by the downflows into the tachic line. It's purely advection. I mean, it exists in the flow takes it down. As simple as that.
So you're saying those fluids, so in terms of, let's say, if I ask what particle makes,
right,
you would say the same thing.
Yeah.
The fluid elements are actually being.
Yeah, and obviously the magnetic field is active. It's a little more active, especially when you amplify it. It has the Lorentz force. So it's not like exactly like a passive tracer, but in this sense, it's moving so fast, it just looks like a passive tracer in some respects, yes.
Okay, one more question.
Norm.
Right. So question is the magnetic field phenomenon that's down in the plume object?
Yes.
Okay, and those plume objects are vortex rings.
They have a lot of vorticity in them.
Now the problem with this would be to take a vortex ring and use it in training magnetic field of fire and
People are doing little models like that. There's Mark Rass does plume dynamics and plume dynamos, and I think Steve has actually done some work on single plume dynamo dynamics as well. So yes, that's true. All right.